need you to wash your hands. Mama need you to wash your hands. Mama need you to wash your hands. I really hope that you use it all.
Well, don't go anywhere except maybe to wash your hands, because we have a terrific golden age of radio for you tonight, featuring a lost episode of Gunsmoke recently discovered. We have a birthday salute to Dorothy Kilgallen. We'll hear an episode of Dorothy and Dick and Dunninger the Mentalist, in which she takes part. And following up last week's Peter Laurie show, we're going to bring you the complete Boris Karloff program we heard the trailer for on last week's show. So you stay right there. Golden Age of Radio follows immediately here on WBAI New York and on the stream at WBAI.org.
Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the past come the historic sounds of radio's bygone days. The golden age of radio rides again.
Are you still there?
That's right. We interrupt our weekly consecutive airings of Gunsmoke to present to you a newly discovered lost episode from early in the run. It's episode number 10. It was highly sought after by the participants. And it's pretty much a two-man show. It's Bill Conrad as Matt Dillon and Larry Dobkin as the prisoner he's accompanying on the ride back. That's the title of it. It actually was expanded into a feature-length motion picture. But this one has been sought after. And Joe Webb, who's been doing so much great work with what's that ABC show? Like Theater 5. Well, he found this in an old collection. An early reel-to-reel collector apparently taped it right off the air when it was originally on. You'll hear the announcement at the end of the station that it came from. And it's caused quite a buzz on Facebook lately. Jerry Haendiges posted a link. Joe gave permission for it to be shared, and share we will. And here it is now from June 28th, 1952, the 10th episode of Gunsmoke, The Ride Back, to start off our wonderful program tonight for the Golden Age of Radio. This is WBAI New York. Oh, and I'm your host, Max Schmid.
Around Dodge City and in the territory on west, there's just one way to handle the killers and the spoilers, and that's with a U.S. Marshal and the smell of gun smoke. Gunsmoke, starring William Conrad. The story of the violence that moved west with young America. The story of a man who moved with it. Matt Dillon, United States Marshal.
Hold up, Martin. Hold it.
You gonna make camp?
No.
Likely clearing over there.
I see it.
Well, then what do you want to... Oh. Give me my gun, will you?
Just take it easy. Just keep looking at them. They'll come out in their own time. We'll wait. You could see him standing quiet in the shadow of the trees 100 yards off the trail. Then they knew we'd seen him and they came riding out into the clearing. Slow. Cheyennes. 3 of them. Young, wearing the pants of white men. One of them had what looked like a woman's blouse around his neck. And tied to their saddles were copper kitchen things that made sharp noise in the still evening. They were close to us now. You could see the shine of their hair grease. Then they were swinging past onto the trail. Back along the way we'd come.
Gee, you. Did you get a whiff of that liquor?
Yeah. You've
been up to something. Lots of trouble in those Indians. Killing trouble, I'd say.
Maybe.
You're the law. How come you didn't ask questions?
When you ask questions, you gotta wait for answers, and that can lead to a lot of grief. My job's to take you back to Dodge City.
You figure they were waiting to bushwhack us?
I wouldn't say.
Lousy murdering devils. If I had me a gun,
I'd do some more shooting, wouldn't you, Martin?
What's the matter, Marshal? You afraid of Indians?
I'm respectful of any man that's got enough liquor in him to make him mad. He does things sudden-like. You ought to know that, Martin.
Huh?
Likely you're gonna hang for it. Now let's get moving. I'd caught up with Leeds Martin this side of the North Fork heading west. He'd done murder. 2 we knew of in my territory and more I'd heard tell about in Comanche country. He was a drifter. Maybe that's why he drank, or maybe because he had other reasons. But it had made him bad. He'd been bad for a long time. I reckoned riding easy would get us to Dodge City in about 3 days. We were traveling light and there was plenty of game along the way. At dusk, we made camp on a low rise overlooking the trail. Martin turned the buffalo meat over a fire, and I watched him.
How do you like it, Marshal?
Enough to take the chill off.
The way I always say, a man should ought to eat meat. What's ailing him?
Yeah, maybe he smells something.
Such as?
Indians.
Those ones we flushed on the trail back there?
Maybe.
How'd he figure?
We're being followed.
They've been... You certain?
I said maybe.
Well, what do you aim to do about it?
Nothing. They stay out of my way. I don't look for trouble with them.
But they're Cheyennes. They got guns. You saw them. Marshal, listen. I got a right to protect myself. You give me my gun.
You afraid, Martin?
I ain't afraid of nothing.
That's good. The meat's burning.
I notice you stay back in the shadow. I get in the light of the fire. They pick me off first, is that it?
It's an idea.
Not for me,
but
it ain't.
I'm going to tell you something, Martin. We got a lot of riding and camping to do together. Now, you can make it easy or tough for yourself. That's up to you. Right now, the meat's burning. I don't like my meat burned.
Take it off.
Then. I'm saying to you, mister, you travel the way you want. I'd as soon tie you on the back of your horse and let you eat and sleep there.
You talk big with my gun, Marshal.
That's right. Are you going to do the cooking or am I?
Many days you say before we reach Dodge?
3, about.
Here.
Thank you.
Now.
Sit over there, will you?
What? Oh, now, give me a break, Marshal. I'm a sitting duck.
You'll be all right. The rocks will protect you.
What's the matter? Don't you trust me close by? I haven't got a gun.
Yes, so you said.
Well, how about a knife? I gotta cut my meat.
Use your teeth. Now, go over, Martin. I'm hungry. Now, we ate. Martin on a rock about 12 feet off, tearing at the meat in his hands. The whites of his eyes showing animal-like as he looked about, cautious, listening. I had a notion to rope him up for the night, but with the Cheyennes around, I couldn't do it. He wouldn't have stood a prayer. So I knew I'd have a double watch to keep. Martin and the Indians. I let the fire die, and the dark came down on us. And with it, the night sounds. A couple of hours moved by.
Sleep?
No.
You hear that?
I heard.
Well, it didn't sound like no proper noise to me.
You better get some sleep.
Oh, I ain't no sleeping mood. You got some tobacco?
Yeah. Here.
Dillon, what's my chances?
I'm a marshal, not a jury.
You know, though.
If it was me, had to say, you'd hang.
You like to see a man die, don't you? Gives you a kick. How many you shot down just for the fun, huh, Dillon? How many?
There's no pleasure in it. Was there for you? Not that it matters, but how many were there for you?
Since I was a kid or since I was a man grown?
Both.
Six. And 2 inches. And you know something? I always got pushed into a gunfight. I ain't saying it's right to do what I've done. But I've had a string of bad luck.
Uh-huh.
Like them two in Dodge, Marshal. They started a fight. No reason. I was faster on the draw is all. And that's always the way it's been.
The doc says those boys are plugged in the back.
He's a liar.
Sure.
What's that? Huh? What's that?
Stay where you are. I'm going to take a look.
You ain't going to leave me here without my gun, are you? They'll come.
Keep your back to the rocks. You'll be all right. Now shut up. They were out there, all right. Somewhere. Waiting. In front of me, the rise sloped down and melted away. And the darknesses that were brush and rock became alive. I got down on all fours, and I eased my gun into my hand. I reached down for a stone and threw it.
Dillon, you okay? Dillon!
I doubt they'll try again tonight. Oh. You better get some sleep, Martin. They got a lot of riding come daybreak. The half light of morning came late. It was the grayness of clouds that held it back. Martin rode down ahead of me, his face as gray as the sky, eyes small for want of sleep. 100 yards from where I'd seen the flash of the Cheyenne's carbine, we saw the Indian lying on his back, staring up out of dead sockets. I buried him, took the rifle, we rode on east.
Still trailing us. You can see him a mile or so back.
I know.
Well, what are you gonna do? Wait for night? Let him try and get us again?
How would you figure to handle it?
Oh, ride back, get on their tails, and finish them.
I'd have to give you your gun to do that.
Yeah.
We'll keep going.
All you'd have to do is wait for them to get in range. I could pick them off, aim for two of them.
Forget it.
Listen, I'm not going
you
to...
You talk too much, Martin. You talk too much about killing. Now, close up.
Hey, look. There's a cabin, see?
Yeah, I see it.
We could get fresh water. Maybe I could buy me some tobacco, huh? Well, what do you say, Marshal?
There's no harm in it. The way you smoke what I've got isn't going to last us in the dark.
Yeah, gear, come on.
Out and back getting the washing off of the line before it rains. I saw some hanging.
Yeah. Hello there. Can we get some water?
Hey, there must be a kid here. Look, rag doll laying over there.
Come on.
Hold him. Marshal. Marshal. Look at that.
Inside the cabin, a man was lying face down. In his outstretched hand, he clutched a broken milk pitcher. The woman was sprawled against the wall. And the kid... She was maybe 5 or 6... All alone, small, hunched up against the bed. Those Cheyennes sure had a lot of hate in them.
The second act of Gunsmoke in just a moment, but first, a reminder. Be a good example to your child. Make him know that he's loved and wanted. Give him regular religious training and help make your community a better place in which to live and grow. Now, the second act of Gunsmoke.
Them Injuns done it. The Cheyennes. They done it. They'd kill a kid. Marshal, you see this? They done it. You wouldn't give me my gun. You wouldn't go after the dirty... I never done anything like this. But me, you're going to take...
We'll bury him out back.
You're worse. You're worse than me. You're worse than the Cheyennes. We'll bury him out back. That's all they are to you. Something dead, so you bury it. You've got nothing in you at all. Nothing.
Shut up. Now, don't tell me about the dead. You do your killing and everything's on your side. So what's the difference with this? Just because some crazy liquored Indians did it. What do you think the wives of the men you shot say about you back in Dodge? What makes you so different? You think maybe because you're not a Cheyenne that makes you innocent and only them guilty? Now, come on, we'll bury him out back.
Big drops of water were falling as I threw a last handful of earth on the kid's grave. We'd put her rag doll to sleep with her. And the killer, Leeds Martin, said a prayer half remembered from a long time ago.
Now, lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. And if I die before I wake, if I die before I wake,
I'd pray the Lord my soul
I'll
to...
pray the Lord my soul to take.
We'll wait in the cabin until the storm gives over.
What about the Indians?
Right now, they're going to get wet. Later, I'll take care of them. All right, we'll tie up the horses over there by the post.
Get out! Now, stay on your belly. Keep close to the cabin.
Where'd that come from?
Off to the right there. Keep your head down. And when I say, we'll make a run for the door. Get inside. You all right?
Yeah, I kicked some dust in my eye.
All right.
Hit one of the horses.
Are you ready?
You're going to let him get away with it? You're going to run once you shoot back?
They're out of pistol range. We're going inside. All right, come on.
You're Lily. I should have figured it. Just a lot of fat talk.
I'm going over to the window, Martin. You stay where I can see you. If you move one inch, I'll blow your ears off.
Now I know why you won't give me my gun. It isn't for me. It's so you won't have to make a play for the Indians. You're scared, Martin. Don't you turn your back on me between here and Dodge. Because if you do, you'll never turn around again.
The rain made everything a gray curtain. I could see a horse moving to the cabin for shelter, and as it came close, I saw it was mine. On the saddle was my rifle, and I had to get it. I had to go outside again for that. The Cheyennes had been well out of pistol range. You could tell from the sound of their shots. I didn't think they'd have the stomach to get too close. Not yet. I waited about 10 minutes. And then...
What are you going to do?
We're going out, tie up the horse, and get my rifle and back in.
Suppose they're waiting for us.
They're not, but if they are, like you say, I'm not turning my back on you, so you'll go first. Now open the door.
I ain't going to do it.
Open the door, Martin.
You ain't got guts enough to pull that trigger.
I don't want to shoot you. Open it.
Now! You hear me?
Go on, outside. Come on, boy. Come on, boy. Boy. Yeah. Easy now. Easy now. All right, get the pack off, Martin.
Oh, whoa, boy. Down. Oh, down.
Hold it, boy. Easy. Easy now. All right, come on. That's a boy. That's a boy. All right, tie him up, Marty. All right, let's get out of this rain. The afternoon dragged by, and with a storm came a chill, and I got a fire going. I kept my watch at the window, an eye on the horse, an eye on Martin. He wasn't talking much now, just moving around the cabin, looking at things the way you do when you try to find out what people are and what they own. It got darker. The rain didn't let up. We drank hot coffee and ate. Martin found a guitar. Propped himself up on the bed. Get your boots off the bed.
Why?
You're getting mud all over it.
Who's gonna care?
I do. You wouldn't understand why. Now get them off.
Aim to sit by that window all night, Mark.
As long as I have to.
You'll need some sleep by and by.
Don't worry, I'll hogtie you if I do.
Engines might get you when you sleep.
I'll get you too.
come a man and woman come to a place like this to settle and raise a kid?
Lots of room, maybe. Work in the earth. There's reasons.
All crazy. What did it get him?
I don't know, Martin. That's the way it goes.
Oh. Yeah, I guess I'm ready for some sleep.
Okay.
Oh, you don't have to tie me. A man gets all stiff. Sleep's hard to come by then.
I'm going to tell you something, Martin. Some men, an ordinary man, even if he's done murder, I might trust in a fix like this. But you're not like that. I don't understand you. You run hot and cold. There's something wrong inside your head. I don't trust that. All right, now get started on your feet. I'll knot it tight. Take your boots off first.
I could do with a drink.
Make another loop there. All right, now pull it tight. All right. I'm going to finish it, Martin. Now keep your hands behind your head and lie down flat.
Sure.
Why, you crazy son. I'm not even started with you yet, Martin. Now get out. I should have done that a long time ago. Now you hear what I'm saying, Martin. I don't like you. You're making a lot of trouble. I could save the law a bother by throwing you to the Indians right now or doing it myself, but you're going to stand trial. If I have to drag you at the end of the rope, you're going back. Now get up on that bed and stay there. He didn't have any more fight that night. I roped him up and dozed a little myself. But by morning, when the rain let up, I could see that he was cocky again. Ready, waiting for another chance. Outside, the sun was breaking through, and there was a smell of freshness, green and wet. The horse was nibbling at some timothy going along the cabin wall. There was the sound of the cow wanting to be milked.
You think those Cheyennes are gone?
They might be. I doubt it, though.
Funny they ain't tried to pick off your horse.
Probably want it alive. You finished your coffee?
Yeah.
Okay, let's go. What are you doing with the guitar?
Taking it with me for company. They don't need it.
Put it back. Put it back.
Seem like you're just bound to make things tough for me, Marshal.
Seems that way, doesn't it? Well, it's a nice day, Martin. We ought to make some distance to Dodge today.
You're going to let the Cheyennes get away with this, huh?
They won't get away with it. Now, come on. We doubled up on my horse and took it easy for the morning. You could see for miles around. It was that kind of clearness. And then we were heading for a shallow canyon with rocks and boulders dotting the floor. There'd been no sign of the Cheyennes until we entered the mouth.
Jump! Come on, boy. Hi-ya! All right, behind the rocks, Martin. Get out.
Yeah, persistent, aren't they?
Man's a fool to ride into a trap.
He sure is.
Give me my gun, will you? Give it to me. I want to get just one of them. Just one.
Sorry, Martin. You'll have to sit this one out.
You don't understand. Got him. Oh, please, Marshal. Please, I give you my word. Please, let me get the other one. Please, I'll give you back the gun, Marshal. No. I won't make no trouble. Now, please,
no,
Marshal.
No, I can't, Martin.
Please,
just Marshal. Sweat it out. It won't be long.
Look, Marshal, please, just
now, listen
one...
to me. I'm going to edge around those rocks down the canyon.
No, Marshal,
I should
give
be
me...
able to pick him off from there. Now, you stay put here. You understand?
Marshal.
You'll be all right. You stay here. I crawled my way up Marshal, the canyon, sneaking behind brush, boulders, anything for cover. And up on the lip of the canyon, I could see a movement, a flash of color. And that was when Martin raised up. He had a couple of rocks in his hands the size of small melons, and he ran like a jack, dodging back and forth and heading straight for the Indian.
Now, Martin! Martin, get down! Get down!
The Indian slid down and landed no more than 10 feet from Leeds Martin. They were both dead when I got there. A Cheyenne shot had got Martin square in the head. I took my prisoner's body back with me to Dodge City.
Now, sir, there's just no accounting for some men's ways, Mr. Dillon.
Yeah, you never know, Chester. You never know. I didn't like him, but you never know.
Must have been crazy, in a way.
I couldn't figure out why he did it. Until I found this in his pocket. Here, take a look.
Well, it's a kid, Mr. Dillon. Picture of a little girl. Looks like he'd carried it for a long time.
Yeah. Maybe he had a kid once. You never know. And like you say, it's just no accounting.
Gunsmoke, transcribed under the direction of Norman MacDonald, stars William Conrad as Matt Dillon, U.S. Marshal. Tonight's story was especially written for Gunsmoke by Anthony Ellis, with music composed and conducted by Rex Corey. Leeds Martin was played by Larry Dobkin. Parley Bear is Chester. Join us again next week as Matt Dillon, U.S. Marshal, fights to bring law and order out of the wild violence of the West in Gunsmoke. Our exciting free offer again. You may have for your entire family a free convention handbook. Send a postcard with your name and address to Time, CBS, Chicago 90, Illinois. That's Time, CBS, Chicago 90, Illinois. Don't wait, the conventions are coming. Your copy's waiting. This is Roy Rowan speaking. And remember, Playhouse on Broadway brings you outstanding dramas and comedies every Sunday night on the CBS Radio Network.
KNX Los Angeles, where Gene Autry rides the range every Saturday at 8:30 p.m.
And this is WBAI New York. Thanks to Joe Webb, Jerry Handiges, and collector Jim Pox, who recorded that right off the air. And now we're down to 4 missing episodes of the hundreds and hundreds of Gunsmokes that were broadcast. That one recently discovered, never before broadcast since the original date. And I hope you enjoyed it. It was turned into a motion picture. Later on, long sought after episode of Gunsmoke, The Ride Back, June 28th, 1952, the 10th episode of the series. Well, last week, here on the Golden Age of Radio, WBAI New York, we played, in honor of Peter Lorre's birthday, an episode of The Inner Sanctum that was an Armed Forces Radio Mystery Playhouse program that was hosted by Peter Lorre. And at the end, they played what they called The Green Room, coming attraction for next week's program. And Mimi Rosenberg, the host, one of the hosts of Building Bridges here on WBAI, 7 p.m. Monday evenings, and the Thursday morning show, too. But she's a fairly devoted listener to this program and demanded that we hear the complete Boris Karloff program that was previewed last week. And by George, we have that very next episode of the Mystery Playhouse. It's from a series that Boris Karloff was featured on called Creeps by Night that was heard on ABC Less than a year, in 1944. This episode is the sixth episode of that series. From April 25th, 1944, Those Who Walk in Darkness, Boris Karloff, who I believe at the time was in New York, appearing in Arsenic and Old Lace, which is why he did a lot of radio in New York at the time. So without further ado, I believe Mr. Laurie hosts this one as well, because it is Mystery Playhouse from the Armed Forces. But it's Creeps by Night featuring Boris Karloff here on the Golden Age of Radio, WBAI, New York.
Mystery Playhouse, a rebroadcast for the servicemen and women of the United Nations.
Good evening, this is Peter Lorre. The circumstances leading up to horror and tragedy are many times as innocent seeming as a Sunday school picnic, and the perpetrators of evil appear often as ordinary, normal human beings. Yes, but they are capable of conceiving acts of diabolic destruction, as you will hear tonight in the Mystery Playhouse. Listen now to Mr. Boris Karloff in Those Who Walk in Darkness. We look in on a scene taking place in a private room at Bayside Hospital. A man with heavily bandaged eyes lies restlessly in a bed. At his bedside are his wife, Valerie, a nurse, and a famous eye surgeon, Dr. Paul Wade. Dr. Wade looks strangely and intently at his patient before he speaks.
Change the dressings at midnight and again in the morning, nurse.
Yes, doctor.
Well, doctor, what did you find? Will I be blind? Is it very bad?
Now, take it easy, Mr. Denton. There's nothing to worry about. Nothing at all.
You're sure? You aren't just saying that.
I'm quite sure.
Valerie, did you hear that? I'm not going to be blind. Valerie, where are you?
Right here, darling.
Did you hear? I won't be blind. Isn't that wonderful?
Yes, darling, it's marvelous.
You don't sound very excited. Valerie, don't you realize I'm going to see again?
She doesn't sound excited because I don't want you to be excited, Mr. Denton. You've got to relax. Try to sleep.
Sleep? With this ungodly pain? My eyes feel as though they were on fire.
That will stop as soon as the opiate I gave you takes hold. You'll be comfortable, I'm sure. Now, good night.
You're going now, Doctor?
Yes, I'll look in on your husband in the morning.
Stephen?
Yes, Valerie?
Do you mind if I step out into the corridor for a moment?
But you promised not to leave me. I'm afraid, Valerie. Everything's so dark,
The nurse will be here, dear, if you want anything. I just want to ask Dr. Wade some questions.
Questions? But he's already told us...
Yes, Stephen, I know. But I'd like to find out about the treatment and how I'm to take care of you when we get you home, you know. Just little things.
All right. But hurry back. I want you near me.
I will, dear.
Good night, Mr. Denton.
Good night, Doctor. And thank you.
You're quite welcome. After you, Mrs. Denton.
Thank you.
I suggest we step into the consultation room across the hall. We'll have more privacy.
All right.
Here we are.
Thank you.
Well, it's been a long time, Valerie.
Yes, Paul, it has.
Almost 10 years, isn't it?
About that.
Strange that you should have called me, of all people, to treat your husband's eyes.
Oh, I was panicky, Paul. I didn't know what to do. It all happened so suddenly. Stephen was working in his laboratory at the house when suddenly I heard a violent explosion. I ran in and found him clutching his eyes and screaming, "I'm blind!" First thing I thought of was an ambulance. Then you...
Why didn't you think of me 10 years ago?
That's not fair, Paul.
Was it fair to turn your back on me and then to marry a man almost twice your age?
Paul, please, why bring up ancient history?
It isn't ancient history to me. I've never forgotten you.
Paul, about Stephen's eyes.
What about them?
I have a feeling that you weren't telling him the truth.
You're right.
Oh, you mean he's not going to regain his sight? He's going to be blind? Oh, Paul.
You don't expect me to be terribly concerned, do you, Valerie? After all, he did take you away from me.
Don't be vindictive, Paul. It wasn't Stephen's fault. He didn't even know of your existence.
And you never told him that we were on the point of being married?
No, never.
It's rather ironic that we should meet again at the bedside of my rival, your husband, a man who may forever walk in darkness.
Don't say that, Paul. It's horrible.
But unfortunately true. A moment ago, you told me not to be vindictive. I'm not, really. But if I were, I could have my fill of vengeance if I told him about us. And then told him that he'll be blind forever.
You wouldn't, Paul.
Or I might take another form of revenge. I could tell you that an operation is called for. A very delicate operation.
Are you trying to say that there might be a chance?
Yes. But supposing I refuse to perform the operation?
Paul, you're joking. You can't mean that.
Perhaps not. But you call me vindictive. Suppose I operate, and my scalpel slips. What if he dies?
That would be murder. You're not a murderer, Paul. You wouldn't risk your professional reputation. Why must you torment me this way?
You really love him, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Then forget the things that I've been saying. I want you to think of me as a friend. I want you to trust me.
I do trust you, Paul.
Thank you. Now as to the possibility of surgery. Here is the situation. The transparent film over your husband's eyes, the corneas, were burned and torn with the explosion. They've been so damaged that blindness will result, even though the eyes heal.
But you think an operation would cure that?
Possibly, although it's a very delicate job. The injured cornea must be peeled away and replaced by a fresh, healthy one.
Where can you get healthy corneas?
From the eyes of the dead.
Oh.
It isn't quite as horrible as it sounds, Valerie. You know, dying people often will their eyes for just this purpose. We maintain what we call a corneal bank. It's much the same as a blood bank, only but there's this difference. Corneal tissue can't be stored more than 48 hours. It must be fresh, or it's no good.
You have some available in the bank?
No, that's the trouble. I'm afraid we haven't.
But there's got to be some, Paul.
I don't know where, Valerie. Unless...
Unless what?
I was just thinking. Last night, one of the interns asked me to look at a charity case that puzzled him. He lives in a dirty little shack near the waterfront.
Yes, Paul?
I stopped by and examined him. I found an incurable condition. There's no way to save him. He won't live more than a day or two, but his eyes are healthy.
You mean you think he might...
I don't know. You'd have to have his consent, of course.
Take me to him, Paul. I'm sure I can make him understand.
Oh, it may not be so easy, Valerie. He's a strange person. A mystic and a spiritualist.
Let me try. Just take me to him.
All right. We can go there now.
Thank you.
anyone live down here, Paul? Wet streets and the fog rolling in from the river. It's a shudder.
You'd be surprised where people are forced to live. That's the house over there. That gray shack.
Does he live alone?
No. There's a toothless old woman. I don't know where he picked her up, who keeps house for him. She's rather hideous and, I suspect, a bit demented. So don't be frightened when you see her.
I'll try not to be.
Here we are. There's no bell.
Those foghorns are giving me cold shivers.
Yes, they do sound eerie. Here comes the old woman.
Yes?
We'd like to see Chandra, please.
You can't. He's getting ready to go away. Chandra's going on a long journey.
Yes, we know. We'd like to see him before he leaves. We are friends of his.
Eh?
I said we are friends of Chandra's. I was here last night. Don't you remember?
All right. Come in. His room's at the end of the hall. You know the way. I have to stay here by the stove. I'm cooking something. Yes, something for Chandra's journey.
I see. Come, Valerie.
Something for Chandra's journey. Yes, I'm really nice. Chandra's going away.
Paul, she's ghastly.
But harmless, I'm sure. Here, this is the room.
Dark in there.
Yes, but there's a lamp burning. But the wick is down. I'll turn it up. There, that's better.
Paul, there on the cot. Is he alive?
Yes, still alive. Chandra. Chandra.
Who calls Chandra?
It's Dr. Way. You remember me? I was here last night.
Yes. Chandra remembers, but it is too late. I am going away on a journey.
I know. That's why I've come. I've brought a young lady with me, Chandra. She has a favor to ask.
Chandra has no favors to grant. Soon I will start to the other side.
Let her tell you what she wants, Chandra. Now go ahead, Valerie.
Chandra?
Well...
Chandra, my husband suffered an accident. An explosion. His eyes. Oh, Paul, I can't. You tell him, please.
All right. Can you hear me, Chandra?
I hear you.
Now, this young lady's husband just lost the sight of both his eyes. He'll be completely blind unless I perform an immediate operation. Unless I take parts of two healthy eyes and place them on his. She's asking that you give her your eyes. Do you understand?
I understand. I am visited by those who would rob me.
But you're going to die anyway.
Die? No, you are wrong. There is no death. I am going on a journey.
Please, please help me, Chandra.
No, I will need my eyes. I will need them to see into the great beyond, to guide me through eternity. The eyes are the windows of the soul.
I'll give you anything you ask.
No, no, I said no. No, I... Oh.
Paul, something's happened.
He's dead.
Then it's all right. You can take his eyes.
No, I can't. He refused you.
Paul, listen to me. A doctor's first duty is to the living, to heal them, to make them whole. What responsibility have you to this lifeless thing?
It's a matter of professional ethics, Valerie.
Paul, you've got to do it. For me. Blindness would drive Stephen out of his mind. He's always hated the dark, like a little boy. Paul, please.
It wouldn't be right, Valerie.
It's a matter of life and death, not right or wrong. Paul, Paul, you have your surgical kit with you.
Yes, but...
Paul. Paul. Please. I beg you.
All right. Close the door.
Well, it's good to be home again, Valerie. That hospital room was beginning to get me down.
It's going to be even better once the bandages are taken off.
Yes. Just another week, that's what Wade said. Oh, he's a good doctor, Valerie. I like him.
I'm glad.
Imagine being able to see again after all these weeks of darkness. I've never liked the dark. Why, it will be like coming into a new world. Yes. Tell me, what sort of an operation was it, Valerie?
Well, I don't know.
You sound like you're trying to hide something.
Oh, don't be silly, Stephen. Oh, that must be Paul. Dr. Wade, no. I'd better let him in, Stephen. I think Jenny's in bed.
Good evening, Mrs. Denton.
Good evening, Doctor.
Sorry I'm so late, but I had an emergency call.
Oh, it's quite all right.
Hello, Doctor.
Well, how's the patient?
Oh, fine, fine, thank you. And anxious to get these bandages off.
Patience is a virtue.
Yes, but blindness is a curse.
Don't be so morbid, Stephen. You're very lucky.
Yes, I know I am. It's a warm night, isn't it, Doctor?
Yes, a lovely night. Stars and a new moon.
They say a new moon's a good omen if you look at it over your left shoulder. Did you know I was superstitious, Doctor?
Well, I guess we all are in one way or another.
Yes. Oh, would it be all right if we took a short walk in the garden while Valerie makes some coffee? That is, if you have the time, Doctor.
Yes, plenty of time.
Well, can't I come along?
Oh, no, this is a stag party. You fix some coffee for us like a good girl, and we'll be back shortly.
All right.
Here, we can go out through the terrace.
Here, let me take your arm.
Thank you, Doctor. What a gorgeous night.
Yes, isn't it? See how the moon is... Oh, sorry, old fellow. I forgot for a moment.
That's all right. I'll be seeing it soon enough, thanks to you. And now you're seeing it for me. Over my left shoulder, I hope.
Why, no. It's the right one.
That's bad luck. Oh, but you couldn't possibly bring me bad luck, Dr. Wade. Not after giving me back my sight. You'll never know what you've done for me.
No?
No. You can't possibly know how much it was because you're not in love with Valerie. Valerie's my life, Doctor. So young, so beautiful. Without eyes, how could I see her beauty? I'm getting on in years, you know, and there'd be very little left for me if I couldn't look at Valerie and see the warmth of a smile. Oh, I don't expect you to understand that. Nobody can understand it except the one who's in love.
Perhaps you're right. It must be very pleasant to see with the eyes of love. Even though the eyes are borrowed.
Borrowed? What do you mean?
Oh, why, nothing. Nothing, really.
That's not the truth, Doctor.
Shall we keep
walking? No, I want you to explain what you meant when you said my eyes are borrowed. It had something to do with the operation you performed, did it not?
Now, look,
I won't be put off. I told you I was superstitious.
Give me back my eyes.
Who said that? Dr. Wade?
Who said what?
Give me back eye.
There, a strange voice.
I didn't hear anything.
Yes, yes, I heard a voice saying, give me back my eyes.
Give me back my eyes.
There. There it is again, Doctor. Oh, for the love of heaven, whose voice is it? Tell me. Tell me, I'm blind, I can't see.
I think perhaps we'd better go in, Mr.
Denton. No, 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 I tell you, I heard a voice.
Oh, but you're tired, now come.
But I... All right. I can't understand it. I swear I heard a strange, hollow voice.
There was no voice, at least. None that I heard. Here we are. Step up. That's fine.
Back so soon?
I think you'd better go right to bed, Mr. Denton. You're tired and unnerved.
Yes. Yes, I will.
Coffee will be ready in just a few minutes.
Oh, I think I'll retire, Valerie.
Is something wrong, Stephen?
He's tired.
Oh, here, let me help you.
No, no, don't bother, please. I can find my own way. You stay with Dr. Wade. Doctor, are you sure we didn't hear?
I'm positive.
I see. Well, good night.
Good night.
I'll be in shortly, Stephen.
All right.
What happened, Paul?
I'd rather not discuss it.
Oh, please, you must tell me.
Well, it's something I've been worried about.
What do you mean?
I haven't brought this up before because I was hoping against hope that the thing I feared was not true.
Paul, you don't have to hide anything from me. Is something wrong with Stephen?
I'm afraid so. I'm afraid the explosion injured his brain as well as his eye.
Paul!
It isn't going to be easy to take, Valerie.
What happened in the garden?
He said he heard a strange voice saying, give me back my eyes. Oh, I shouldn't be telling you this, Valerie. You're trembling.
Oh. I'm thinking of that Hindu, Chandra. You said he was a mystic, a spiritualist. Do you think it's possible that... Oh, no, it couldn't be.
No, Valerie. I'm afraid Stephen's brain has been affected. And the horrible part of it is that I'm convinced the complete insanity will set in eventually.
Stephen!
I heard what you said, Doctor.
Oh, Stephen.
It's all right, dear.
Stephen, darling.
Come back into the bedroom, Mr. Denton. I want to talk with you. No, Valerie. You stay out here. Or better yet, go and get me some hot water.
Hot water?
Yes, I think I'll change these bandages and I'll want the water boiled. So watch it for at least 6 minutes.
Very well. I'll go to the kitchen.
Now, Mr. Denton, shall we go into your room?
It's no use, Doctor.
Let me guide you. There. That's fine.
I know you're trying to cheer me up, but I tell you it's no use, Dr. Wade. I understand. I'm going mad.
I'm sorry you overheard. After all, I could be wrong. Although...
Although you know it's true.
I may as well be frank with you, Mr. Denton.
Give me back my eyes.
That voice. I tell you, Doctor, I keep hearing that voice.
It's nothing. Your imagination is working overtime. No, I'll get you a sedative. Valerie? Oh. Oh, here you are. I thought you were in the kitchen getting some water for me.
No, I didn't go. You didn't fool me asking for hot water.
Fool you? I'm afraid I don't understand.
You monster. You horrible monster.
What are you talking about?
Get away from that door. Let me go into my husband. Let me tell him...
Just a moment, Val.
Get your hands off me. Let me go. I should have known right from the beginning. Instead, I trusted you, had faith in
Valerie.
Me. Spalding me.
Make my skin crawl.
Valerie, I demand an explanation.
You'll get it, all the explanation you want. I suspected something wrong when you sent me for hot water. That was just to get rid of me. Get me out of the way for 6 minutes. But I didn't leave this front room.
Now listen.
I did listen. Bedroom door didn't quite latch. I saw what you did. He couldn't see you because his poor eyes are bandaged. He's blind. But I saw your lips move, and I heard you say the words, "Give me back my eyes."
Valerie, will you please let me...
If you don't get your hands off me, you unspeakable monster. Trying to drive Stephen mad, playing on his superstitions, his fear of the dark, of the unknown, to turn him into a raving maniac.
Valerie, be quiet.
Quiet? Why, you filthy, despicable... What was that? Stephen! Stephen! He shot himself. He's dead. Oh, Stephen.
Valerie.
Go away. Go away.
Valerie, it was all for the best.
The best?
Let me talk to you, Valerie. I can explain everything.
You murdered him.
I did it for you, darling, for us. Come into the living room and let me explain.
You murdered him. Just as if you'd held that gun to his head and pulled the trigger yourself.
Please, darling.
Go away. Leave me alone.
Valerie, believe me. I did it to free you from a man who didn't deserve you. I did it so that you could know happiness with me. You're young, Valerie. You have years ahead of you. You're entitled to everything in life. Do you understand? Come into the living room. There, that's it. We're going to be so happy together. Let me close the door and shut out the last memory of what has gone before. Now, our life is before us. Here, sit down.
My head, Paul. I have a terrible headache.
I'll get you some aspirin. Where is it?
In Stephen's laboratory. I'll get it.
Let me help you. There.
I think it's on the middle shelf. Turn the light on, Paul. The switch is on the right.
I have it. Let me get the aspirin for you.
I can find them more easily.
I've been thinking, Valerie. After this is all over, we are going away on a trip. Perhaps somewhere off in the mountains or... You've got the wrong bottle, dear. That's not the aspirin.
No. It's one of Stephen's chemicals. It's acid, Paul. Sulfuric acid.
Well, Valerie, put it back on the shelf. That stuff will burn.
No, Paul. No, you cold-blooded murderer. You're going to know what Stephen knew before you forced him to take his life. You're going to know what it is to walk in darkness.
Valerie.
Forever.
Down my eyes! Oh.
There, my friends, is a young lady who takes literally the old adage, an eye for an eye. Thank you, Boris Karloff and cast, for keeping our growing reputation for horror quite intact. And now, ladies and gentlemen, if you'll follow me, please, I want you to visit the green room. The players are rehearsing our next performance. Come. Come, come.
Watson, what do you know about this man, Damery?
Damery? What Damery?
Lord Damery, of course. You seem to have this photograph in all the society weeklies.
Well, naturally, the fellow's a household word in society.
Yes. He's a man of the world with a natural turn for diplomacy, and he's asked me for a 4:30 appointment, which I've granted.
You mean that Lord Damery's coming here, but it's 4:30 now. Look at the mess.
Oh, yes. Sherlock Holmes and the elementary Dr. Watson, played by Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce, respectively, will appear in our next tale of mystery. This is Peter Lorre closing the doors of the Mystery Playhouse. Good night. Sleep tight.
This is the Armed Forces Radio Service.
Elliot Lewis as the voice of the Armed Forces announcer. And that was Mystery Playhouse, hosted by Peter Lorre, a rebroadcast of Creeps by Night, the sixth episode, originally heard on June 20th, 1944 on ABC. Because Mimi demanded it. There it was, Those Who Walk in Darkness. Well, we turn next to a birthday girl, Dorothy Kilgallen, born in 1913. Father was a reporter. She was a columnist and did some investigation into the Kennedy assassination, which some say led to her death. Well, we're not here to ponder that question at the moment, but we are going to hear her as one of the three guest judges on the Chemtone Hour, better known as Dunninger, the Master Mentalist program from the Blue Network, June 15th, 1944. Chemtone Paint, along with Dorothy Kilgallen, are Shep Fields of the Rippling Rhythm and Joseph Auslander, who will be introduced in time. And couple of announcers on the show. You'll hear Glenn Riggs and Jackson Beck as Dunninger astounds the world by reading the minds of the audience, both in person and from afar. Let's listen now to Dorothy Kilgallen guest starring on the Dunninger program. This is the Golden Age of Radio on WBAI New York.
Here is the Chemtone Hour with Dunninger, the Master Mentalist. Chemtone's the miracle wall finish that
paints an average room for only $2.98.
Goes on living rooms, dining rooms, bedrooms, and playrooms like magic.
Goes right over wallpaper, paint, or wallboard. Mixes with water, dries in an hour, washes easily.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, the gentleman who, with his unique skill as his only weapon, invades your mind and reads your thoughts, Dunninger.
Thank you, Glenn Riggs. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. There's one error in Glenn's description. I cannot invade against opposition. I need your cooperation. You must want me to get into your thoughts before I can. What do you say? Do you want me in there? Well, then, here goes. Concentrate. I receive an impression from some lady or gentleman that is concentrating his or her mind upon the initials JB. I get the name Captain Jim. Does that make sense to anyone? The gentleman about the fifth row center of the auditorium is answered. That is your thought, sir?
That's right.
Would that be Captain Jim Blair?
That's right, sir.
You're asking me mentally where he is at this time?
Yes, sir.
Do you know the answer?
I do, sir.
You simply wrote the question, where is he?
That's
right. You want me to tell you the answer?
Yes, sir.
The answer to that question, incidentally, appears only in your mind, is not placed upon paper. Would that be Caroline Ireland?
That's right, sir.
That is correct. I thank you. Caroline Ireland. Another impression which I receive comes from someone concentrating his or her mind upon a birthday. A day in the month of July, the 25th day in July. Where does that come from, please? July 25th. Who is thinking of July 25th? The gentleman about the 20th row on the right side of the auditorium. The young man with the mic is going up to him. You have to climb a number of steps to get to him on a long cabled microphone. Is that your thought, sir?
Yes, but not a birthday.
Your own? You were born in 1888?
Not a birthday.
Not a birthday. Were you concentrating upon 1888?
No year concentrating.
The gentleman here is doing the thinking. Sixth row, center of the auditorium. You see, I can't pick the individual that does the thinking. Would that be correct, sir? The 6th day of June, or rather the 25th day of June, 1888?
Correct.
Just by form of variation, since I've selected you for this test and had a bit of difficulty locating you, would you take some other number in mind as well? Are you now thinking of a serial number, perchance? Is it your own number? Yes or no?
My own.
Good. I'll see if I can get that as well. Would that be 10539?
Correct.
That is correct. Thank you very much. say, you're great. There's so much good thinking going on that I really hate to stop.
But we have our judges to introduce, Dunninger.
I know, so do the honors. Will you, Glenn? Then we'll continue.
Tonight's guests represent journalism, music, and the arts. That sounds like a museum. But our judges are too much alive for that. They are the famous author, Broadway columnist, and playwright, Dorothy Kilgallen. The popular band leader, Shep Fields. Our third judge is the great poet of World War II, whose famous poems have appeared in the Saturday Evening Post and Life and thrilled the nation, Joseph Auslander. Miss Kilgallen, you're noted for your insight. Do you have any into Dunninger's methods?
Only hunches.
Want to tell us?
No, thanks. I'd rather have more to base them on first.
What say, Dunninger?
Yes?
Well, I'd rather have more to base the hunches on first.
I see. Well, then watch closely. Here we go again. I receive an impression from somebody or gentleman concentrating his or her initials upon the name. Concentrating upon the initials K-R, rather. Kelly is the first name. Where does that come from, please? Kelly is the first name. The last name begins with an R. Seems to be Kelly Rogers. Does that make sense to anyone? It does. It makes sense to the gentleman about the 40th row, center of the auditorium. Is that your thought, sir? Kelly Rogers?
That's the last two names. There's a first name you haven't gotten yet.
Oh, the first one I haven't gotten yet, I see. But that is part of it.
Yes.
You want the first name as well?
Yes.
Would that be Pat?
That would.
It would. And this number you're thinking about, is that Pat's number?
Yes.
What type of number is that, my son? My dear son?
Well, that's my dog, and that's his license number.
His dog, and that's his license number. I know this thing will go to the dogs eventually, George. Well, you want the dog's license number. You want Pat's license number. Would that be 7812?
Yes, that's it.
Good, fine. All right, thank you. What lady is concentrating her mind upon a thought? The thought seems to be, what is the name of a phone number I found in my husband's wallet? I don't blame you for not raising your hand to that one, Maddie. I wouldn't either if I were you. Don't you trust him? I see. You do. You just wanted to know. Well, we'll pass that up. Who is thinking of the Westchester Association? You, sir, the gentleman about the 50th row, way up to the center of the studio. Is that your thought, sir? Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Did you ask me to give you their phone number?
Right.
Do you know it?
Positively.
Oh, Danny, you're very certain about it. Well, I hope that I know it as well as you do, sir. Would it be White Plains 223?
Exactly correct.
I thank you, sir. I thank you very much. I get an impression of the digits 109, line 14. Where does that come from, please? 149, line or dash 14. That's part of a number. Will you please raise your hand, because I cannot identify it. The rest of the thought seems to be the digits 4901. Whose thought is that, please? Is that yours, young lady? Is that yours?
Yes, it is.
That is your thought. Thank you very much. I now receive the impression of someone thinking of June 15, 1941. Where does that come from? The young sailor lad on the right side of the auditorium about the 15th or 16th row. Is that your thought, sir?
Yes, it is.
That is correct. I thank you. And now, who is concentrating his or her mind upon the digits 3716? It's an address. Part of an address. 3716, the lady about the 12th row. Is that yours?
That is.
That is correct, madam.
That is.
Is that your own address?
That's my number.
Your own number?
And the street number was also there.
You want me to give you that?
Please.
You'd like that. Perfect. Will you think of it very hard?
Yes.
Perfect. I'll try to do that. Would that be 80th Street?
It is.
It is. Thank you. Who is concentrating his or her mind upon the number of a bill in his or her possession? Piece of money, a bill. I get the initial B. That is the series, B, and the digits. Where does it come from, please? Oh, you have a bill also, madam,
yes.
In your purse?
Yes.
Good. The lady has a very good mind for this type of work, and she thought she'd put me through a second test. Does anyone in the audience know the number of that bill other than you, Mary? Are you the only one that knows it?
I think so.
You're not sure of that?
Well, this lady may hear.
She says she doesn't.
There's no one else.
I see. Well, see if I can help you out and see if I can get it accurately. Would that number be 224-158-52 Series A?
It is.
100% accurate.
Accurate.
I think. All the impression which I now receive seems to come from someone concentrating his or her mind upon a name beginning with a C. The name of a place, I get C-A-T-O-Z-E-L-L-A. Where does that come from? That is the lady about the 70th row. It's quite a task getting up there to the young lady. Is that your thought, young lady?
That's right.
Is that a place in Australia?
I want to know whether Mr. Catazella is in Australia.
Well, I couldn't answer that.
I'm no fortune teller.
I can only give you your thought, and that is your thought, is it not?
Right.
Thank you. That is all that I can do for you. An impression which I now receive comes from someone concentrating his or her mind upon a question. Shall I return to New York or return to? Where does that come from, please? And the two, the lady about the center of the auditorium, about 20 rows. Is that your thought, young lady? Is that correct?
That's right.
You made that notation at home, did you, upon your own stationery?
No, right here.
And your own stationery?
That's right.
You simply wrote the question, is that correct?
That's right.
Not the answer. Is your name Quinn, perchance?
Yes.
Winnie? Is that initial S?
That's right.
Good. I can't answer that question because it has something to do with the future. No man can honestly answer that. You appreciate that fact. I can only give you your thought. That is right, is it not? That is your thought, is it not?
That's right.
I thank you.
What about those hunches now, Miss Kilgallen?
After that very convincing performance, my principal hunch is that Dunninger reads thoughts.
What about you, Mr. Auslander?
Miss Kilgallen's always been noted as an authentic source of information. I wouldn't want to argue with her.
Well, that's very gallant of you, Mr. Auslander. Are you going to let the lady have the last word, too?
No, I'm not.
Die hard, huh? Well, what's your pleasure, Sheffield?
Well, I'd like a little more proof right now. In fact, I think we all would.
I see. Well, I'll tell you, I'm gay, Mr. Fields. But I'd like to make a bargain with you.
I've heard that gag before. You mean, if you read my thoughts, I've got to do something for you.
Right. Say, who's doing the thought reading here anyway, you or me?
You, if you try this.
Well, what's it about?
It's about fathers.
Uh-huh.
Miss Kilgallen, Mr. Auslander, and I were discussing Father's Day, which, as you know, is due on Sunday. We decided that if we had a chance, we'd test you on this. What are the three qualities we agreed every father should possess?
I see. That is the simple little job you picked out for me. Incidentally, I've not asked you to make any notations of these thoughts, have I?
No, you haven't.
How about you, Miss Kilgallen?
No.
Perfect. Would you then be kind enough to be the first to concentrate your thoughts upon this one qualification that is paramount in your thoughts, Miss Kilgallen? Please, think very hard. You haven't any difficulty doing that, I'm certain. Would you perchance be thinking of the one simple little and ever-important word of patience?
I would.
That is right. Mr. Fields, how about you, sir? Would you be kind enough to concentrate your thoughts upon some quotation that you think acceptable at the moment to the qualifications that father should exercise?
Yes, I will.
Think very hard. It is an effort, is it, Mr. Fields?
Very much of an effort.
Well, sometimes it is hard to concentrate. But aren't you concentrating likewise upon one lone word? One word, not a sentence. Is that right, sir?
Yes.
Perfect. Is that word, let me see, understanding, would that be accurate?
That is.
That is likewise correct. Understanding. And now, Mr. Auslander, I'm certain that you have selected an unusual thought for us along this particular field of endeavor. Concentrate, please. Well, naturally, you would think of that, wouldn't you? A sense of humor.
That's right.
That is right. I thank you.
Well, Dunninger did it. Now your turn, Mr. Fields.
Well, what do you want me to do, Dunninger?
Well, I'd like to hear you sing.
Oh, I was afraid of that. I don't sing myself, but I brought my vocalist, Meredith Blake, with me, just in case. I'm sure you'd like to hear Meredith more than me. Besides, she's pretty.
You're telling us. Come on up here, Miss Blake. And what will you sing for us?
I'll sing Embraceable You.
Oh, wonderful.
Embrace me, my sweet embraceable you. Embrace me, you irreplaceable you. Just one look at you, my heart grows tipsy in me. You and you alone bring out the gypsy in me. I love all the many charms about you. Above all, I want my arms about you. Don't be a naughty papa. Come to baby, do. My sweet embraceable you. I love all the many charms about you. Above all, I want my arms about you. Oh, don't be a naughty papa. Come to baby, do. My sweet embraceable you.
Thank you, Meredith Blake. And good luck to you when you open with Shep Fields and his orchestra at New York's Copacabana Club this Friday. Today is Flag Day. To honor our flag, we have asked Joseph Auslander to tell you about the 6th of June, 1944, D-Day. You are all familiar with his series, The Unconquerables, the epics of our allies that appeared last year in the Saturday Evening Post. Also, with his Invasion Eve sonnets, The Last Four Words, that appeared a few weeks ago in Life. Now you will hear for the first time Joseph Auslander's poem titled The 6th of June, which he wrote on Invasion Day. Mr. Auslander.
This flag that speaks to us of home, symbol of freedom, faith, and pity. This flag brings liberty to Rome, brings truth to the eternal city. And now upon the soil of France, in the cold, ghostly light of dawn, old glory greets the anxious glance of men who wave our banner on. This flag for which men gladly perish, for which so many men have died, to hold the way of life we cherish by blood of brave men sanctified. This is the flag of Bunker Hill, of Gettysburg, and Belleau Wood. The flag for which our heroes still pour without stint their precious blood. From Midway to the Coral Sea, from Attu to the Solomons, this is the banner of the free. This is the flag of freemen's sons. The flag beneath whose folds tonight on Norman beach and Roman plain, the troops of God and freedom fight evil and tyranny again. Now, let each heart renew its prayer and pledge to that proud flag its all. By land, on sea, and in the air, God grant that flag may never fall. Oh, let us gird our strength and give double our strength, that soon may come that day when men in peace shall live, in God's peace, lead our heroes home.
Thank you, Mr. Auslander. Our battle station is on the home front. Our job is to buy war bonds. The more bonds we buy, the better our chance to greet the returning soldier with pride. Buy more war bonds, and buy them now. Buy more war bonds tonight. Last week, Dick Powell, noted screen star, suggested a mental miracle in connection with the plot of his new picture, It Happened Tomorrow, directed by René Clair. Dunninger will attempt to prove long-distance telepathy. Dunninger will give you tomorrow's headline today. Seated at his desk, some distance from here, is Herman Thomas, an editor of the New York Daily Mirror. He has not yet completed the headlines for tomorrow morning's late editions, but he is thinking about them. With us is Dorothy Kilgallen. She will call the city desk of the Daily Mirror. The editor will pick up the phone and concentrate on what he will write as the headline. The editor will not speak to Miss Kilgallen. He will only concentrate as Dunninger reads his thoughts, and Dunninger writes the headline in bold white type on a dark slate in full view of the audience. Only then will Miss Kilgallen ask the editor for verification. Anything else, Dunninger?
No, I think you've described that very, very well indeed. Miss Kilgallen has now kindly gotten up from the judge's table, has walked to the center of the studio stage, seated herself upon a chair comfortably, has the telephone. Your ear. Have you made the contact, Miss Kilgallen?
Is this Herman Thomas?
Yes, he's on.
Perfect. Am I correct in asking you at this point, Miss Kilgallen? You are not familiar with this headline at this time.
No, I'm not even familiar with the man.
I see. Very good. And the other judges, Mr. Fields, Mr. Auslander, neither of you know anything pertaining to this information.
Absolutely not.
Is that correct?
No. Nothing whatsoever.
Inasmuch as that information is entirely unknown to everyone, with the exception of the gentleman on the other end of that phone, the young man in the office, at the mirror, it would be needless for me to ask you if any written notation has been made. No notation could be made of anything that isn't known. Is that not a fact?
That's true.
Would you now, Miss Kilgallen, be kind enough to ask him to concentrate his thoughts upon the very first line of the headline that he has selected?
All right.
For tomorrow morning's paper.
On the first line
of the headline
that you've written.
I have a large slate here in my hands for the benefit of my...
Hello, are you concentrating? Don't tell me what it is.
Don't let him tell you what it is. Simply ask him to think of the first line.
First line, yes.
Or the first word. Now take the next, please. In his mind.
Now think of the next line.
That's correct. Now the next. As Miss Kilgallen is asking him to concentrate his thoughts, I am writing the information as I receive it.
Well, now, wait a minute.
I know.
How many
lines are you
assuming?
Yes, the third. His third word, please.
Are you thinking of your third word? Think of the third word now.
He's thinking of the third word. At this point, you do not know what any of these words are.
Yes, that'll do any line. It doesn't make any difference.
That's correct. You don't know what any of these words are at this time, do you, Miss Kilgallen?
Yes, he's thinking of the third word now.
The third. Now the next one, please.
Now think of the fourth.
I'm writing that upon a large blackboard here. Miss Kilgallen cannot see what I am writing, nor can the audience. But I hope to show it to Miss Kilgallen and the audience in a few moments before the verification is made over the phone, which I trust will be 90% accurate. Ask him if he has completed the sentence.
Have you completed the sentence? Yes.
Perfect. I'll show this to the audience, consisting of over 450 persons. Now I turn my slate to the stage for Miss Kilgallen to see. Please do not read my sentence, Miss Kilgallen, but do ask him over the phone to tell you the unwritten headline that he has been concentrating upon at this enormous distance from the studio.
Now will you tell me what the headline is?
What is it, please?
U.S.
Yes.
Fleet.
Yes. The next.
Shells.
And the last.
Kareli's is the last word.
Is that correct?
Have
I it correct?
100% correct.
100% correct.
Well, there you are. What do you say to that, Miss Kilgallen?
For the first time in my life, I'm speechless. That man is good.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Miss Kilgallen. You, Mr. Auslander?
I think he's wonderful.
And you've had an enjoyable and pleasant time.
I've had a very enjoyable evening.
Thank you, sir. And how do you feel, Mr. Fields?
I'm stunned, that's all. Dunninger is miraculous.
Dunninger, it's right back to you again.
Thank you, Chef Phil, Dorothy Kilgallen, and Joseph Auslander for being with us. Thank you very much.
Now, here are this week's $50 bond winners in Chemtone's final letter-writing contest, which closed June 10th.
Mrs. Elizabeth M. Slattery, Albany, New York.
Mrs. Melba Beck, Grovetown, Georgia.
Staff Sergeant R. M. Eastman, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
Miss O. E. Hackman, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Congratulations. Your war bonds are in the mail. In addition to the $300 in war bonds awarded this week, Chemtone is mailing certificates good for 1 gallon of Chemtone to the writers of the next best 100 letters received. Now is the best of all times to make your rooms new again with Chemtone, the miracle wall finish. Be sure to get genuine Chemtone, the most amazing paint you have ever seen. Next week, we will broadcast from Chicago. And our judges will be
the Honorable Edward J. Kelly, Mayor of Chicago.
Lula Fields, better known as Lula Bell, popular star of the National Barn Dance.
Ranslow P. Shearer, Chairman of the War Finance Committee for the State of Illinois.
And Dunninger will attempt to locate and describe an original war bond poster painted by David Mink, winner of the 1943 Victory Award of the Chicago Art Directors Club. Dunninger will also attempt several other mental miracles that promise an outstanding Dunninger night. Now, here's Dunninger to say...
George Wiest, may I have another moment here? There are one or two little thoughts that have left me somewhat up in the air because I have them in part, and I'm certainly of interest to my audience to see whether I could work them out accurately. There's one person in my audience somewhat disappointed because I did not get the complete impression concentrating his or her mind upon the digit 64. I get 64 Bell Avenue. Whose thought is that, please? That is the lady about the 55th row on the right side of the auditorium. She's up there with a broad smile spreading over her face. The young man is going up at the mic. Was that your thought, young lady?
Yes, it is.
Is it true that when I concluded my readings, you were more or less disappointed? You turned to the gentleman and said, he didn't get mine, wasn't that
yes,
so?
Yes, that's true.
That is true. So I thought I'd try to get yours. Weren't you thinking of this particular address in Lewistown, Pennsylvania?
Yes, indeed I was.
That is correct. And I likewise got an impression of someone. I'm not certain whether they're on the same mental plane as far as the vibration is concerned, but someone is thinking of Captain Swift. Where does that come from, please? Captain Swift. That is the lady of the... about the 12th row on the left side of the studio. Captain Swift, is that your thought, young lady?
That is correct.
You asked me to tell you where he is at this time.
That's true.
Do you know where?
Yes.
Would that be in Maine?
That is it.
Camden, Maine?
That's correct.
That is correct. And one other thought, please. One other thought. I get the word T-H-E-S-T-L-E. Where does that come from, please? Someone almost fell off a chair there, jumping about halfway down the studio. Is that your thought, sir?
Not exactly. You have one letter wrong.
Is it a certain type of board?
Yes.
Is that not the name of it?
That's correct.
Oh, it is accurate now.
It's the second letter is not A.
I see. It is not an A. It is an R.
It is an R.
I thank you very much indeed.
Now, this is Glenn Riggs bidding you a pleasant good night for Dunninger and the makers of Chemtone and its 50,000 dealers throughout the country. Try Chemtone. No muss, no fuss, no bother with Chemtone, the miracle wall finish. This is the Blue Network.
The Chemtone program featuring Dunninger, the medalist, special guest Dorothy Kilgallen, whose birthday is today. And we're going to jump ahead 12 years for a program that Dorothy Kilgallen had. I believe it was daily. It was a breakfast-type program, as spoofed by Fred Allen. Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick. It came from WOR Mutual. And, well, they discussed the affairs of the day. This sounds like it might be a syndicated version of the program, because there are breaks for commercials that are not there. And given the runtime, it seems to be slotted for a half hour, but we only have 22 minutes. And I'd like to thank Ted Davenport for providing this. There aren't a whole lot of Dorothy and Dick shows around. I have one from 1960-something that came from WOR from a master tape, but these seem to be syndicated versions. So from 1956, there's a phony corset in the museum. It's been exposed. Let's see how are Dorothy and Dick. Dorothy, of course, Dorothy Kilgallen. Dick, Richard Colmer, who was Boston Blackie for most of the run of that show on the radio, among other things. And they were a married couple. And let's have breakfast with Dorothy and Dick, 1956, here in the golden age of radio, WBAI New York.
Hi, darling.
Hi, sweetie. I see you have a pad full of notes on people and places and events around New York City. Glamorous and exciting things, I'll bet.
That's right. Some experiences in this marvelous city that we want to share with our friends all across the country. We'll be back in just a minute.
It is just terrible. It's just awful. I don't know why they have to publish these things and disillusion me. Well, it wasn't Queen Elizabeth's corset after all.
What was it?
Here they've had this corset up in the Folger Shakespeare Library, or down in it. Do you think of Washington as being up or down? Down, I guess.
Washington what?
South. D.C., I believe.
Oh, Washington, D.C. Oh, I thought you meant square or something. I thought you were in New York. Washington, D.C., down.
Yes, all right. Down there in Washington at the Folger Shakespeare Library, they've had a corset. For years and years, they've had this corset there, and it has had a sign on it, Queen Elizabeth's corset.
Just no question whatsoever. That was it.
That was given to the library many, many years ago by a rich chap.
And who exposed it?
Mr. Folger. Because he endowed the whole work thing. And, well, Dr. Louis B. Wright began to harbor some doubts about this.
But he was just standing in front of the corset one day and he said, I bet it isn't. It sounds like me. You know, people are always saying the international dateline is in such a place, or the moon is 8 zillion light years away from the Earth. And I keep saying, how do they know? Maybe this fellow was that way about the corset.
Well, this guy has a bit of doubt and an inquiring mind, I suppose. And maybe he's frightfully honest and wants to be positive everything is authenticated right down to the last hook and eye or corset string. And so what does he do? He could have left well enough alone, but what does he do? He writes to the Victoria and Albert Museum in London and gets a hold of some, you know, double dome over there and has him look at pictures. He has the thing photographed from every angle. And the guy at the museum in London writes back that it couldn't possibly be Queen Elizabeth's corset because it's the sort of a corset that wasn't invented for almost a century later. Now, I think that's unnecessary, and I think they should have left the whole thing just the way it was.
Oh, I disagree with you, Hank. I think it's darling. I think it's
sweet. How does he know?
Well, he took one look and said, that'll never go under a
seen
far
his wife's
than Yale.
Corset, much less a corset of the...
No, honey, he looked at it and he said, that would never go under a farthing Yale. That would stick up too far or something like that. I should think, I mean, an Elizabethan corset is quite familiar looking to any student of the history of costumes or to anyone who's been around a lot of museums. He's probably the only perceptive person. Why should we have things in our museums in Washington, D.C. or New York or anywhere else that are not correct?
Well, I'll go along with you that the circuses and sideshows and carnivals, they shouldn't be showing the fake whales and...
Oh, I don't think that's as important, a fake whale, because that really isn't historic. And, I mean, people are dopes anyway to fall for those things, you know, little things in bottles that they say are something that they're really not. But a museum is different. You trust a museum. Good night. If they put something on the wall and say, this is a Vermeer, you look at it for hours and you say, boy, was Vermeer cool. But, and if they show you a corset and they say, this was worn by Queen Elizabeth I, then you take it for granted that it was. I don't think that's in the category with a circus or a sideshow or a carnival at all. I think they should be
I was rather disappointed when they exposed the Cardiff Giant, you know.
I know you were, honey, because you trust the scientists, you see. You and I are different. I'm skeptical. And I would have asked a few sharp questions of Copernicus, but you're the trusting type, and you think if any fellow belongs to the Princeton graduate school or something, well, swell, you know, he said hello to Dr. Einstein, so believe everything he says. But I don't go along with that. If I feel it's illogical, I will ask questions even of a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's the way the chap was with the corset.
Well,
he would ask even a question of the head of Warner Brothers and the Merry Widow department.
Well, here is a message from one of our sponsors. And to be serious for a moment, I find these things amusing, you see. That's why I like to keep those legends alive.
You didn't think... Now, honey, come, now, just a minute, to be honest. Did you think the Cardiff Giant was amusing?
Oh, I loved him.
But you believed it, didn't you? You didn't just think it was funny. You didn't regard it as a funny legend until the day it was exposed. You were as surprised as anybody else, weren't you? You're not going to tell me you thought that was a hoax all along, but you went along with it because you thought it was a big yacht. Like the Loch Ness Monster.
Well, I liked it. I liked to believe it because as a child it seemed to me romantic.
Romantic? That ugly-looking creep?
Oh, he was beautiful. He was stunning, chap. Very handsome.
Honey, excuse me.
Honey.
No, wait. Just one more question. Until the moment that it came out, like on page one of the New York Times, did you ever for a moment doubt that the Cardiff Giant was real? I just want to know that. Did you? Did it occur to you that this was
Sweetie, this is all a lot of nonsense now. Let's not get too serious here.
No, I just want to... But I'm interested.
The Cardiff Giant was exposed before I was born.
Well, what was the other one that was...
You're getting awful square on this subject.
Well, I guess I'm confusing him with the other one that wasn't. That wasn't acknowledged.
Oh, you mean the one in
the one in England.
Oh,
you know, that was like the Neanderthal
man.
Yeah. Because you mentioned him to me several times in a favorable vein.
Yes, he was rather an interesting-looking chap, too.
Now, you know the one I mean.
Something man. Well, I can't get it now.
Piltdown man. That's the one. I'm sorry. I wipe out everything. Erase the Cardiff Giant, because I don't know anything about him anyway.
Oh, I thought that
but
you were getting...
The Piltdown man...
Straight away about
you,
me and my Cardiff Giant remarks.
No, but you and all the other scientists were very big with the Piltdown man. He was straight away in the books, wasn't he? They had drawings of him... And he was for real, and the kids had to study about him, right?
Yeah, they had a skull in some museum over in England, wasn't
it? Probably the British Museum had lost its charm type of place.
And they discovered it was an old gorilla skull.
Yeah, honey, I don't care where it was. You all of you brains, accepted it. That's what I say. Now, I don't say I challenged him. I didn't know much about him. He looked as real to me as those creeps that they say, you know, this is the
Pithecanthropus erectus that lived...
They say that, you know, this is the history of man or something, and then they say this is how it was. And your great-great-great-great-great-uncle was this chap here on the bearskin rug. You think, wow, you know, who needs him? But anyway, that's what the Piltdown man looked like, right?
And nobody
argued with them. And that's why I'm saying if you're scientific enough, if you're straightaway enough and double-dome enough, you can come out with anything, and the people will accept you.
Just a minute, sweetie.
Yes, dear?
Just a minute is what I'd like to share with our sponsor right now.
An excellent suggestion. I'm with this man that looks at the corset and says, I don't believe it was Queen Elizabeth Clinton's corset. I like him.
All right. Why don't you write him a fan note?
Well,
his name is...
Yes, make him immortal. And
wait a minute.
Repeat his name, please.
Dr. Louis B. Wright. That's the chap at the Folger Shakespeare Library.
I bet Queen Elizabeth was pretty weensy.
Well, I guess all people were a little weensier then, were they?
Yeah.
We know that.
Judging from the...
Looking at the armor of the day, men, those knights that came riding in the shining armor were about 5'2".
Isn't that depressing that Galahad, who was, I guess, much before Queen Elizabeth, but all of those fellows that we read about, Sir Lancelot and everything, that they were little stumpy fellows compared with the present day. I mean, they weren't really like Gregory Peck or Robert Taylor or anybody like that.
Then science in reverse sometimes turns a legend into what could be fact.
You know, they'll
for example, David and Goliath, you know, you say, oh, wasn't that charming? You know, David went out and he put a rock into his slingshot and swung it around and hit this big giant in the temple and the fella fell down. And it all's kind of like mythology and a fable. And you're very happy for having read all these things about the Red Sea parting for Moses and all that stuff. And then along comes a guy and says, you know, I was watching the winds over the Red Sea the other day, and it darn near parted.
and there was a giant standing there, and a little guy came up with a slingshot.
And then another one comes along and says he ran across a tribe down in Africa who fights with nothing but slingshots, and they're killing each other right and left.
Shall we pause now for an interesting message from an interesting sponsor?
Why not? Here is a letter apropos of the theater and my own activities, and it's about showgirls. Here's a letter from a young lady who was at the call.
Oh, no.
Yes. And it's so frank and funny and philosophical that I thought you'd like to hear it. Says, dear Dorothy and Dick, don't be deceived that any of those showgirl aspirants you tried out for the Ziegfeld Follies at the Mark Hellinger Theater were there just for laughs. Those kids were in dead earnest. That's capitalized. I must admit, though, that I did enjoy myself, not so much by parading with shaking knees onto the stage as by viewing the scene in the dressing room before and after the tryout, surrounded by that melee of nervous hopefuls. Each time a new batch of girls spilled through the doorway, all the others eyed them obliquely, mentally summing up, and then dismissing, no matter how dazzling their competition. The professional models were no less wrought up than were the office girls, parentheses, you know, Dick, the ones who had promised, who you had promised, if chosen... Excuse me, just this is a single space, and the print is so light I can't... you know, Dick, the ones who had... You had promised, if chosen, to transport into the $100-a-week bracket. But at least the models had one another to cling to, emitting lusty shrieks of, darling, you here? Is Val coming? Etc. While the non-doe-eyed breed stood hesitantly on the sidelines.
The girls who didn't know how to make up their eyes, yeah. they were a race apart.
Why didn't I think to take a tape recorder? Every gal there had some kind of excuse for having shown up. One plain-faced six-footer with a profound sense of historicity, her lanky legs incongruously ensconced in black mesh hose. Put it this way. When you think of the Ziegfeld Follies, you think of your grandmother. I felt I just had to be a part of this.
I don't quite follow that thinking, but do go on. You mean her grandmother was a Follies girl?
I don't know, and whether she thinks that she looks like her grandmother or...
Her grandmother would have loved this?
Yeah.
Would have wanted her to put on the... Black mesh stocking?
The letter continues. My worst moment was staring out over the footlights. I couldn't see whether the others were smiling, and I didn't want to be the only one to do so. So I devised the idea of making a gay little comment to the gal next to me, thus providing a chance to break into a devastating grin with which to woo you onlookers. That was my mistake. She turned and gave me a long, filthy look, completely upsetting my disposition and changing my expression into a sour, frozen face. My just desserts, I guess, for upstaging. And when it was all over, the indignant rejects sounded off backstage in fury. One husky blonde exclaimed loudly to a sympathetic friend, "Humph!" or something to that effect. This is the first time this has happened to me. My husband, a struggling PhD candidate who was understandably inclined toward economy, had only one comment to make about the whole incident. "Well, there goes another $20. Parentheses. You see, I had paid $19.95 for a perfect knockout of a swimsuit so that I could take you all by storm. Good thing I like to swim."
Oh, I love her. Oh, that's so funny. She can help him with his themes,
yeah,
anyway, for
sure.
His $20.
She says, "Many thanks for a delightful radio program. Good luck with the Ziegfeld Follies. I was only too glad to play my small role in its formation. Very truly yours, rejected showgirl." In parentheses underneath that, "My mother and my husband, poor darlings, both think I am gorgeous."
Oh. Oh, I wish she'd enclosed her picture. Well, you probably had to reject... Well, you told me you rejected several gorgeous ones because they were too short, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Just because you felt that they needed a few more inches.
And, of course, the bathing suit routine was an absolute must because sometimes the toss from the torso up, a girl can be exquisite and the legs are too thin.
No.
Or too fat.
Or not need.
Yeah.
And from that interesting news, we turn to something all our friends will want to hear about.
I don't know what you're going to do tomorrow, but I know where I'm going to be.
Where?
I think I may go out to Central Park and start hunting.
Start hunting what, darling? I thought you had all the Follies, girls.
Oh, you kidding? Oh, there's no point in hunting for Follies girls or any girls when there is money lying around loose. Just look for it. You may have to do a little digging. You may have to take a hammer along, but there are lots of rocks in Central Park. Isn't that true?
Yes.
You've seen the rocks out there. All of Manhattan Island is rock. That's why they can build the skyscrapers so tall here. Good foundations with lots of rocks.
Is that why? I always thought it was just because they wanted to.
Oh, no, dear. That's very important.
Well, what an interesting fact, darling. Thank you very much. You've given me something to think about.
There is a very thin layer of earth over the stones under Manhattan. This whole island is a jagged hunk of rock that juts up between the Hudson and the East Rivers.
And the people who built on it made it jut up even more.
They sure did. They put a spine right down the middle. Well, this news is reaching me maybe a little late, but I'm going to go out with my hammer to Central Park tomorrow. Do you know that an estimated total of 50,000 children and adults last year picked up gemstones in the United States with an estimated value of more than $500,000?
They picked them up?
Yes, sir. And the United States government is encouraging this. They say it's good for people to have a hobby, and when your hobby can pay off...
That's the kind to have.
Whoa, man. That's the greatest.
Now, hold off 1 minute,
yes,
darling, while I ask the undoubtedly silly question, but I do have to know. Are they picking up stones that have fallen out of ladies' jewelry, or are they picking up rocks that have little emeralds concealed within their hearts?
No, sir. These are uncut gems.
And you can find them in Central Park?
That's where I'm going to go look for them. I don't...
Where has everybody else looked for them?
That's the nearest place I can think of. Bob Bach, I don't think, would be awake enough tomorrow, you know, when we start out to make it an extended trip out into Jersey or Westchester or anything. So I figure that I'll break him in Central Park. All right?
Will they let you carry away their rocks?
Well, we'll soon find out.
Yes, I have a feeling that you'll be breaking your first rock when a gentleman in a blue coat with shiny buttons will come along and say, "Hey, buddy, what do you think you're doing?" And we're
removing Central Park.
You'll be breaking rocks.
We don't care for the topography of this particular section, and we're going to level it. No, I'll just explain that the government has encouraged me to do this.
And while you line up some fascinating facts about that, we have some good news for our friends.
Reporting this the other day, the Bureau of Mines said it encouraged rock hunting. The Bureau said it was a hobby that was resulting in a rapid increase in amateur gemstone cutting, too. This is very good for you, or I guess it's good for psychosomatic people.
Gives you something to concentrate on and take your mind off the trouble.
Yes, very therapeutic.
Basket weaving.
The Department of Mines says the weekend treasure hunts sooner or later may lead to a find of an important strategic mineral, such as manganese or nickel. Now, I suppose I think I'll count on Bob to recognize the manganese and nickel when we get to it in Central Park.
Remember I can't even think of what the word would be. I'm so unscientific. But it's something used. I guess it's a mineral, but it's something used extensively now and very valuable. And I discovered it on a plane trip when I got talking to a man who dealt in it. Molybdenum. Please look for some of that.
How did you get through that without fluffing?
Well, I just couldn't forget it now because I had never heard of it before. And you know, this man was telling me what he did. And he said that he was the head of the something or other molybdenum company. And I said, "I beg your pardon. Well, there'll be no strong language in this plane." And he explained to me what it was. Well, now I've completely forgotten what it was. But it apparently is used in extremely essential industries. And therefore, people who go out and find it or find what makes it, I'm so technical, you know, are doing very well. So would you please, if you're going out looking for manganese, keep your eye out for molybdenum, because I think that's even more valuable.
All right. Okay.
It doesn't say where these people go. But so I'm not trying to discourage you about Central Park, because I do think it's convenient, but... If all these rocks are being found in Colorado,
well,
you might better employ your time.
The only locale mentioned here is California. A few years ago, one treasure hunter found a massive jade boulder in California. After cutting, it was estimated to be worth about $25,000. Not bad, hey?
No, sirree.
It worked quite a while to get $25,000.
Darling, the clock's hands are pointing right at us.
And that's fair warning that our time is up. Dorothy and I will pick up more glamorous and exciting news for you from the marvelous city of New York.
And we'll be back very soon for another visit with you.
Hope you'll join us. Till then, goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Goodbye, Dorothy and Dick. Dorothy Kilgallen and Dick Colmer. We celebrate Dorothy Kilgallen's birthday today on the Golden Age of Radio. And, well, we've come to the end of our allotted time. However, Dave Kenny is off this evening, and we have nothing to replace him as of yet. So, I don't know. Should I just carry on for another 2 hours? That's kind of what I'm feeling like. Of course, I will have to berate you to give money to WBAI. As a matter of fact, why don't I do that right now? WBAI, we are in our extended tower fund appeal, trying to make up the money, the back money for the transmitter rent, as well as our studio rent. Three months behind in the studio, 2 months behind at the transmitter, and we need to make that up, because otherwise, well, if we lose either one, we will be no longer able to broadcast. Now, this audience has come through quite nicely in times past.